Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, and Monterey, Faraday, San...
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Okay, thank you very much, Audrey. How many years have you been doing this and you've never failed to get us connected and set up and prepared for the detailed information that we give out on the show, and you've done it every time? That is something that deserves what? I think it deserves, well, what would you think? Applause. And... Anyway, thank you, Audrey. You did it again, and we're ready to go. A little technical problems here tonight getting set up, but I think we're ready here tonight. A lot of strange things going on with my TV network also. I don't know what that's about. Flashes on and off and that sort of thing. But anyway, what we do with a show called Jumble Justice is we try to discuss news, issues, and events and developments in this always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice, and we dedicate the show to the super people who work in policing and court and corrections and juvenile justice professionals, professions who protect us throughout the United States and across the world. And I think it's very good that President Trump has been meeting with some of these justice leaders only 3 weeks in office, and he's got all things going on. We had that silly court decision, I won't even talk about, that happened out in Washington, and that federal court, that court has no business doing what they did, but don't let me talk about it at this point. But anyway, I think you'll enjoy the show tonight, and let me mention a little bit about it. We're going to have James Mitchell, an informed man. He's author of the book called Enhanced Interrogation, Inside the Minds and Motives of the Islamic Terrorists Trying to Destroy America. And I think you will find this very interesting. Of course, we're going to take him off of booktv.org. Remember, that's the site for people who love books but don't read them. But you can listen to that book presented. And he knows the inside story and has done the performance in this business of enhanced interrogation. And most people, most of us don't know a hoot about what that actually is. You think they got somebody on a waterboard, and then they're asking him questions, whether squirting water down his mouth or up his nose or whatever. That is not what enhanced interrogation is. The waterboard may play a part in it, but not in the questioning. So I think you'll really enjoy this. This will be information that 99%, literally, of people don't know anything about. So, and he's very good at presenting this material, and the book is outstanding. So, okay, that's it for getting us started. We want to thank Blog Talk Radio for getting us going. I'm going to be a little quick on the news tonight because I want you to hear James Mitchell as much as we can. Let me crank up the news here. That's a little delay problem also, too. So let's see what can happen with that. I don't do the actual stories to actually talk about it, actually. But I think we'll get started here in just a minute. I hope we will. And the world is going on here technologically. Audrey, can you figure this out? Are we being hacked or what? Anyway, we're going to give it a try. All right, let me talk about this news without looking at the stories. The city of, we've had 121 killings in a period of 4 years by people convicted. And they're immigrants, not deported. In other words, 121 killings in 4 years by convicted immigrants who were not deported. You hear these news people talk about this, they don't have a hoot what they're talking about. 121 people in 4 years have been killed by convicted illegal immigrants who were not deported. Now, isn't that something? We also know that Obama, in his criminal reduction program, remember when he provided amnesty for all these people and let them out? Well, one of those guys is back in for guess what? Dealing heroin and big time drugs and all that stuff. And my news is still bouncing down on my the bottom of my computer, so I think it'll jump up here in just a moment. But anyway, before we do the news, let's do some of the other stuff that we know we can do without detailed facts. We have a Bond joke for tonight, and here's the joke. Why are Bond jokes one-liners? And the answer to that is so brunettes can understand them. Remember, on our blonde jokes, we're always talking about blonde men. I want to be careful to be sure about that. All right, here's our green tip for the night. I think a lot of people have been into this a long time ago. You know what it is? Wash your laundry in cold water. It will work. You can wash your... I think we did it in the Marines back in the Ice Age. We washed our laundry in cold water. I do want to mention something very interesting tonight. And it's an occasion for this year that we should know. We've had Vera Lynn sign us off every night of our radio show since it started, 10 years ago, 8 years ago, 9 years ago, something like that. But Vera Lynn just turned 100 years old. Do you know the woman is still singing? And she is turning out her a record album that people want. And it's all of her hits over the years. Remember, she started during the Second World War, right after the Second World War, when it stopped and all that business, and sang for the troops and all that business. But her song that she sang with us, We'll Meet Again, at the end of our show. And she's a great singer, and she's 100 years old and still performing. Can you believe that? That is absolutely remarkable. In fact, I think some of these recordings are on. You can go to YouTube and get a lot of her recordings. That would be a beautiful album to buy. She knows what we're doing. We're still trying to raise the news. Give me a second here. I think it'll happen. I think so. I'm using Evernote. You ever use it? Sometimes it's wonderful and sometimes it's slow. And it looks like it's moving slow here tonight. It says that it's open, but I don't think it is. Hold on, I'm very sorry for this. Usually doesn't happen, does it? Audrey, got any ideas? I don't either. Unbelievable. Still trying to get it up. All right, we got that up. That's our link for James Mitchell, which I think you'll really enjoy this gentleman. Hear him talk, and let's see if we can get Evernote to open our news stories. There's some good ones tonight, very interesting facts. And it doesn't look like it's going to get the thing open. Isn't that incredible? Okay, Evernote, it's time to open. We're going to give it a few more seconds, and if not, we'll just go through these. Anyway, one of the things that's going on is New York Police Department under Mayor de Blasio, they're going to backtrack on their stop and frisk a little bit and put more restrictions on that. You got to remember that stop and frisk is one of the best things that ever happened to the police. And that doesn't mean that you just walk up to somebody on the street or a back alley or wherever they are and just reach in their pockets and look for a gun and their backpacks and that type of thing. You have to have suspicion. And on a proof continuum, you've got what? You've got at the bottom, you've got no proof, then you've got suspicion, and you've got reasonable suspicion. So when you go up to, then you've got probable cause, and when you move up to the middle, probable cause is what you need for an arrest or to get a search warrant, that type of thing. And then preponderance is right in the middle. It's right over the middle. It tips the scale. So to have suspicion is pretty far down on there. You don't have to have much, but you have to have some reason to stop them. Then, based on that stop, if something else occurs while you're there or you see something else or you notice or something's odd, you think they might have a weapon, you have reasonable suspicion, not even probable cause, not even half the proof on the proof scale, you're allowed to pat them down on the outside. And if that gives you a feeling that that was a weapon inside, a knife, a gun, whatsoever, you can reach in their pocket, pull it out. If they have a gun, illegally carrying it, then you can arrest them. And that stomp and frisk, which came out of a case in Cleveland, by the way, that was a case that allowed police to be more safe on the street and to make more arrests, and nobody was a better user of this than the New York City Police under Mayor Giuliani and a couple of his police commissioners in that state. But anyway, it's kind of interesting thing to see what happens. All right, let's see if this one will click on. Gun sales across the nation, by the way, are up a whole bunch. It's a Thursday regular at a Hiya Supply and Tool Company, John Horn. He stopped up to back corner of the hardware store. We leaned gently on the selling side of a glass case full of guns. Gauger opened the gun nook in 2010. The pink pen's a sign of a woman's growing interest in women's interest in guns appeared a couple of years ago. And that hangs from the ceiling, a jet black 50 caliber Browning machine gun, accurate at more than 1,000 feet. They can't buy that. But anyway, rifles and shotguns line the wall, and his business is just absolutely booming. And Obama didn't like these guns, and he put more restriction on that business. But in the first three quarters of 2016, the AG's office reports the sheriffs across the state issued 93,851 concealed carry permits. In fact, I just talked to someone, I won't tell you in the process of business where they were, but 22,000 more than all of 2015. Can you believe that just in the three quarters? And people are worried about what's going on now with these restrictions on the police and the crime rates starting back up. These illegals are still on the street. We're not getting them out of there. We think that we'll do that under President Obama. But anyway, that's interesting. The Chicago police, that's kind of a boring story. But anyway, they're going to high tech. They're going to do different kinds of analysis. They're going to expand their technology. It's called ShotSpotter. That's being used in several major cities to help police detect when someone fires a gun. And they've actually tested these. It works. When a gun goes off, they find out immediately about it. In other words, they don't have to wait for somebody to call the police. Therefore, their arrival, if they can get there under 4 minutes, that's a That's a figure that's lasted a long time in criminal justice research. Cops, they get there under 4 minutes in a lot of things. Then they can save lives of drug overdoses and all sorts of things. But anyway, I mentioned Obama's, what did I say, amnesty? pardon, same thing. Obama's pardon case, a Texas guy was serving a life sentence on drug charges. Guess what? He's back behind bars after cops caught him with more than 2 pounds of cocaine following a high-speed chase. Okay, I thought this one is really nuts, but I'll save that one for next week. One more. Yeah. Well, maybe not. Let's do this one. I was going to save this for next week because I like to talk about the death penalty because my co-author in our Introduction to Criminal Justice book, which is in its ninth edition, Bob Baum, has a whole book on the death penalty and writes about it as a real expert. That Mississippi lawmakers are advancing a proposal to add firing squad, electrocution and gas chamber as execution methods in case a court blocks the use of lethal injection drugs. In other words, they're saying, look, we're going to end the left-wing radicals. They're going crazy over that because they're against the death penalty altogether. But all these states have been tied, not all, but many of these states have been tied up with this lethal injection thing. Does the drug hurt you? Does it go out? I won't go into all that, but you've heard about that at least in a general way for a long, long time, where they're saying, look, the guy that did the Oklahoma shooting, the Oklahoma bombing and all that, remember that guy? How did he die? He died by firing squad. Guess what? It works. It works. I wouldn't want to do it, be a member of the squad, but, you give blank bullets to 4 or 5 people, and one guy gets the real one, and they shoot, and it's all over. The Death Penalty Information Center says of the 33 states with the death penalty, only Oklahoma and Utah have firing squad as an option. And guess what? The firing squad does, in fact, work. So I don't know why people would be against that. Anyway, we'll call that our news story for tonight. And we'll go ahead and play the Ohio Coalition's public statement against firearms. Of course, they don't think you should have any guns.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
All right, Ohio Coalition. You haven't done very well because the gun sales in Ohio are way up, so you need a little more public information out there to get your cause figured out. The social media thing, I like to mention that as it relates to criminal justice. You know the people that are insane about this, their cell phone and Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and on and on and on. Sweden, of all places, Sweden rapists are broadcasting their rapes live on Facebook. Now, wouldn't this be something that Facebook, I guess you could do something on Facebook and instantly have it apply. I don't use any social media, but anyway, can you believe how crazy you would be to do that? What kind of insane people, first of all, to do the rapes, and secondly, to broadcast it live and then watch it and look at themselves like they're heroes of some kind. I mean, absolutely, absolutely nuts. But anyway, you've heard more crazy stories than that. I could tell you one about some guy here in Tiffin. He's been eating at Chipotle's for, I don't know. Audrey, do you remember the number of days? Like, 60, 70, 80, 90 days or something like that. And he's trying to break the record. I think the record is like 200 and some. And he's every day he eats there. These are days in a row. And he's trying to eat at Chipotle's like 200 days in a row. And, of course, he's become what? A media star. That's kind of like the Chinese guy that broke the selfie record. Didn't he do like 500 of them or something? He quit his job to break the selfie record. Absolutely nuts. Okay, that's it. What we're going to do now, we're going to listen to James Mitchell. And Mitchell, and he's going to talk about his book, Enhanced Interrogation, Inside the Minds and Motives of the Islamic Terrorists. I think you're really going to enjoy this, and you'll only hear part of it on my show, but I want you to go to that site and listen to it on the booktv.org. booktv.org, but give me time to get this thing set up. It's loading slowly. Stay with us. In the world. Audrey, maybe we should play music while this is loading. Unbelievable. What in the world? Snowstorm can affect that, can it? I don't think so. Still working. Oh, there's his face, so I guess pretty soon we can turn him on. Okay, here we go. I'm going to start a little bit beyond the opening so that you can hear a little more of him actually speak. Mr. Thiessen is actually doing, this is the American Enterprise Institute, and Mr. Thiessen, who's a resident fellow there, Mark Thiessen, is actually doing the interviewing, so when you hear him talk, it'll be Thiessen here to start with. I think.
Hey, Dub. Sam's took about 3 weeks. And then after that, there was no enhanced interrogation for
At a forum like this about this, and so we're very honored that you chose to join us here at AEI. Thank you for coming.
Well, thanks for having me.
James Mitchell.
So the details of enhanced interrogation have been widely discussed and debated, and I'm sure when we get to the Q&A we can get into some of those questions. But I'd like to focus today primarily on what you've learned from these terrorists and talking to them. But just so people understand that the conversations with KFM that you're describing weren't happening while he was strapped to a waterboard.
Oh, no.
Can you explain the difference between enhanced interrogation, debriefing, and also what you call how you do in business, right? Walk us through that.
Okay. These enhanced interrogations that I was part of really only dealt with about 14 of the top folks. I didn't have anything to do with the mid-level or low-level folks at all. Most of these interrogations took place over a period of time of about 2 weeks. KSM's took about 3 weeks. And then after that, there was no enhanced interrogation for KSM, you know, none at all. And so our goal in doing the enhanced interrogations was to get them to make some movement, to be willing to engage in the questions instead of rocking and chanting and doing the other sorts of things that they had previously been doing. And once they started doing that, we switched to social influence stuff because we know that the real way that you get the cooperation that you want is not by trying to coerce it out of them. It's by getting them to provide the information in a way that they don't feel particularly pressured to do it. And we had to be very, very careful when we were doing enhanced interrogations not to ask leading questions, not to try. We weren't interested in confessions. You know, I don't ever know. In fact, I don't know. I've dealt with 13 or 14 of the worst ones, right? KSM, Zubeda, Ramzi bin Nasheeba, Al-Nasri, the coal bomber, I've dealt with a lot, and none of them refused to identify what they had done. I mean, so it wasn't a matter, we weren't looking for confessions because confessions won't stop attacks. What stops attacks is actionable intelligence. And the way that you can get the actionable intelligence dealt with is by to get through these enhanced interrogations, get them working with you so that you can use social influence after that to get the information that you want. Because so what we did was we moved very quickly to debriefing. And the way that worked is, for the CIA, interrogation was questioning a person who was deliberately trying to withhold information and was hostile about providing it. And it usually involved at least the possibility of some EITs, although we didn't. You might be authorized to do EITs for 15 days, but we wouldn't do EITs for 15 days, right? As soon as they started working with us, we moved away from it. And then after that, we would gradually bring the subject matter experts in, because I'm not the guy to be asking the questions. The guy you want asking the question is the expert on whatever the question is that they have. So we would bring in one case, the person who wrote the president's president's daily briefs, because he had questions that he wanted to ask Abrazuela. So we would bring in other people, and we would sit in there with them and help them without any kind of coercion at all to ask the questions that they were hoping to get. And then once the person was completely able to, meaning the detainee, was willing to engage with the debriefer, we got out of it. You know, we stepped back. We might still monitor. We might still go in the beginning to see how things were going. But you need your WMD experts asking about WMD. You know, Jim Mitchell's not the guy to be making up intelligence requirements. That's done by huge numbers of experts who are experts in the field. What I think is almost irrelevant. They would give me briefings on who these people were and intensive briefings on what was expected before we did it. So you had interrogations, which usually took about 2 weeks. And then their entire rest of the time they were with the CIA, they were never subjected to EITs again. Never. Right? So KSM had 3 weeks of EITs and then never again. Not even when they were trying to find out the location of bin Laden. Not even when they were trying to get him to provide information that would allow us to identify the courier. And we knew he was lying to us. We did not use EITs on him because EITs were to be used to stop catastrophic attacks. And if it wasn't an attack, Jim wasn't interested in doing it. You know, and since I worked for them, they weren't interested in doing it either. They don't want to beast people to find out where somebody's hiding, right? So there were interrogations, which were short. Then there were debriefings where you dealt specifically with intelligence requirements. And then there were a variety of other meetings that we had with the detainees. In my book, I call them maintenance visits because that's what the CIA called them. But we had great concerns about these guys once they started working with us getting sour because they were in isolation. And so we would just stop by and play board games with them or go to the basketball court and play basketball or go to the gym and lift weights with them or watch a movie with them. You wouldn't think that from listening to what people say on TV, right, about what we did. But, in fact, we did a lot of that. And KSM is one of those guys. He's like Yoda. He likes to sit there and talk. So you might go play basketball with Hassan Gul, but you wouldn't do that with KSM. He wants to tell you things. And he had two kinds of things that he did. He had a chalk, an alcohol board, you know, one of those dry erase boards, and he loved to lecture. And so we would go and listen to him lecture. So he'd have something to do when he wasn't servicing intelligence requirements, and occasionally something useful came out of that. The other thing he liked to do when we came around and said, with the how you going things, is he'd like to sit there and talk to you about what was on his mind. Whatever was on his mind. And he thought he was a Sufi. I guess he still thinks he's a Sufi. And so he liked to tell you about his religion. And what I do in my book is I take all of the things that they've told me over the, you know, 6, 7, 8 years, whatever it was, from the beginning, and I bring them all together into one place and talk about it in one setting. But those things that I write about in the book, those things that I write about in the book are not one session where we sat down and we had somebody on a waterboard asking them to tell us about their religion. That wouldn't have worked, and that's not what we did.
So EITs were to take people from a state of resistance to a state of cooperation, primarily, right?
Right.
But, and so
they never fully cooperated, did they? I mean, they always had secrets that they were going to protect. There was nothing that we could have done to KSM to get him to tell us Bin Laden's location. But he told us, inadvertently, by lying, right? Because he would tell that story. Because there's been a lot of people who said the CIA interrogation program had nothing to do with the operation to get Bin Laden. They lied to you. They resisted. They misled you. You got nothing of value. It was actually other means that got us to Bin Laden.
Right.
It is true that KSM lied to us. What's not true is that we didn't know what that meant. It is true that Abu Faraj lied to us. But it isn't true that we didn't know what that meant. KSM's nephew, Omar Abolucci, I think, after EITs, that we're done, right, we're now in the debriefing stage, tells us that, well, you know, KSM told me that Ahmed Al-Kuwaiti delivered a letter to Abu Faraj appointing him the chief of external operations. So now we're interested, right? Because if he delivered a letter from UBL to Abu Faraj, we believe that they don't know where he is, because in 2002, UBL went underground. He didn't even use electronics. There was just a few people. But here we've got a guy who is saying that there was a courier using his jihadi name, his Abu name, who delivered a letter from UBL to Abu Faraj, appointing to him. So because Omar Balucci said KSM, did we go to KSM? And KSM says, no. Hey, that guy used to work for me. He was a protege of mine. He was an associate of mine. But he retired in 2000. He doesn't know what he's talking about. We go back to his nephew, and his nephew says, he's lying. I don't know what that little guy's doing, but he's lying to you, right? And so we think, wonder why KSM's lying. Could this guy be important? Well, what most people don't know is they had established a secret way to communicate with each other, the detainees had, so KSM could get messages out to the troops. What he didn't know is that we knew it, and that we left it there because we wanted to see what he was saying to the troops. So we're asking him about Abu Ahmed Al-Kuwaiti, and he says, the guy, he's quit. Then he puts in a secret message, whatever you do, don't tell him about the courier. Don't tell him about Abu Ahmed. So what we are thinking is that guy has to be important, because here is a relatively cooperative guy who some people would say probably experienced the worst that, you know, you could experience in terms of EITs, who was willing to risk going back to that to protect the identity of this one courier. So that eventually they got Abu Faraj, the guy who got the letter. And he said, I never heard of that guy. I don't even know who you're talking about. There's never a guy like that. But we had been asking all of these other detainees about it. And so we had Hassan Gul, for example. Hassan Gul, before EIT, said,
who was Hassan Gul?
Hassan Gul was a facilitator that worked with, a high-level facilitator that worked with KSM, you know. He goes, there could be two, three, maybe more people working with Bin Laden. You know, he's disappeared. He's got a small group of people. It could be him. It could be him. After EITs, it's him. He does this. He moves letters. You know, he moves people. He works for him. It made it clear that this other stuff was just a smokescreen, and that this was the case. Also, we had a detainee who said, well, one of Bin Laden's wives, not his youngest wife, who Bin Laden had with him, one of Bin Laden's wives gave Abu Faraj a letter to deliver to Bin Laden. So you got to be thinking, well, you know, I wouldn't give him a letter to deliver to my wife if I don't know who he is, and I don't have some sense that he can actually get to her, you know? And so all of these little clues kind of fell into place, and then the brilliant men and women at the CIA who are analysts and targeters were able to put it together. There was a partial true name for the courier that was already in the database out there. But we didn't know how important that was or how to find him. But I interrogated probably the shortest interrogation that ever took place, less than 10 minutes, a guy by the name of Abu Yasser. And after that, when he moved almost immediately into debriefing, he said, this guy that you're interested, Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, has a speech impediment. When he talks in Arabic and Pashto. The agency was then able, through means, to find out where that guy who spoke like that lived. And then the question is, how do we, because we knew he was living, or we had been told he was likely to be living with bin Laden, staying with bin Laden, because essentially he had no outside contact. And so then what they did was they tried to find out whether or not bin Laden was staying with this guy, Abu Ahmed. And that's the process that that happened. So it wasn't the case that, you know, somebody's hands were lapes taped to a steering wheel and somebody was cutting their fingers off it was hard work that was done on the part of the CIA analysts to piece together this matrix of stuff. Some of the actionable intelligence becomes actionable only when it's placed in the greater context of what you know from everybody.
But the Feinstein Commission and Senator McCain and other people say, we already have the name of the guy. We got it from somebody who wasn't in the program, and we would have gotten this information without EIGs and without this program anyway.
Yeah, the problem with that is when you roll up a detainee in the beginning, they would say, tell us everyone that you think Osama bin Laden knows. And they would run off 100 names. And there's nothing about a single name that highlights their importance. So it's like picking up a phone book and saying that because somebody's name is in the phone book, we should have known that he was the guy that was going to rob the gas station. It's just that's just not the way it works. You need something, some cue to take you to that piece of information to highlight that guy's importance. And another thing, unless I'm confusing this, it's clear in my book, but unless I'm confusing it up here on the stage, the guy who gave them his name thought he was dead. Right? They thought he was dead. And it was the smart, clever work by the CIA analyst who was able to determine that, no, this guy was confusing him with his brother or something like that, and the guy that he actually identified, Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti, was still alive. So in hindsight, it's easy to – it's like doing one of those little labyrinth puzzles, you know, backwards. In hindsight, it's easy to put the – because you know where they're at. You know where the cues are. But I'm telling you, the people who put this thing together, not the interrogators, but the analysts who put this thing together were brilliant. To be able to get back into that intelligence database and hunt hard and review all those things and piece together this matrix that led to him was amazing.
The analogy Mike Hayden, former CIA director Mike Hayden, uses is that it's like putting together a puzzle with tens of thousands of pieces, but you don't have the picture in the cover of the box.
Exactly.
And then what these detainees provided was the picture in the cover of the box.
Right.
That's a fair way to do it.
Yeah. What happened is the only two detainees that were denying that Abu Ahmed al-Kuwaiti was probably UBL's courier were KSM and Abu Faraj. The rest of them were providing bits and pieces of information that could be put into the larger matrix. So
most of us have, you know, nobody has heard from KSM since the 9/11 attacks. The most we've seen of him is we've never seen an interview with him. The most we've seen is that disheveled picture of him after he was picked up.
That was his actual capture photo.
Yeah. What was KSM like?
Well, in the book, I call him a devil and a diva. You know, in the beginning, he was belligerent. You know, he was really belligerent. Here's what you need to know about KSM. KSM, for two or three days, was held in Pakistan, and he was questioned or tried to be debriefed by CIA officers. And in a standard, non-coercive, like you would debrief an asset, right? And they tried tea and respectful conversation. One of them dressed up in Pakistani dress and spoke, you know, perfect. And so, and that guy, KSM described to me later, was a clown. And most of the time, I don't believe he was, but KSM thought he was. Most of the time, KSM rocked and prayed and quoted the Quran and acted belligerently. And there's a lesson here for today. I'll interrupt this thought. Some people are saying you can get more out of these high-level detainees with food and a little bit of drink, but that didn't work for KSM. He told me, I'm not going to give up my God. I'm not going to turn on my God for a handful of dates. You know, what are you thinking? And because that's when he was describing the behavior of the other person. Then after that, he went to a place that in Feinstein's report she calls the COBOL, he was treated badly there. Right? And then he came to us. But in each case, he had an opportunity before EITs to answer the question with no coercion at all, just provide some information with no coercion. So I did, the way it worked with us, with me and Dr. Jessen, is we would do something we call a neutral assessment in the beginning. And that is I would just come in and talk to you and say, this is the kind of information we want. So with KSM, I went in and I said, we need information to stop operations. We know you don't have all of it, but we think you have some of it. You know, we have reason to suspect that you have people on the ground. In the United States, we have reason to suspect that you have other operations in the works. And he looked at me and told me, you might hear from me when I get to Washington, D.C., meet that cowboy, George Bush, and talk to my lawyer. And I said, that's not going to happen, you know. And so I asked questions several different ways, and then he looks at me and says, soon you will know. I'm asking him about these other attacks. Soon you will know. And then I go into this in great detail in the book because I don't want to waste your time going into it now. But basically, I had this little spiel that we use, which is, I say, in every man's life, there are moments of opportunity. There are times when the decision you make forever changes your future. And you can't go back. I want to be sure that you understand that this is one of those times. You have until I walk out of this room to work with us. We know you don't know everything. We know that there are people out there doing things in your name, and you may not know precisely where they are, but you know something. And we're interested in that something. And so the next time you see one of us, things will get rougher. But before that happens, you're going to be given the opportunity to answer this question. And so we ask him the question. And then the next time he comes out before EIT start, they ask him that question. I mean, you just ask him that question. It's called a bridging question, and the whole point of the thing is to give him a chance to think about it. Does that answer that
question? Sure. And so once he went through EIT, so he was belligerent and resistant, and then once he went to a state of cooperation, what was he like?
Immensely charming. He reminded me of Yoda. It was like visiting a Sufi master, you know. Everybody thinks he's pure evil, and he is pure evil. But what I used to tell the folks who would come after EITs were over, right, I would tell them, sometimes you rub the devil's belly, sometimes you poke him in the eye. We're in the belly rubbing stage with KSM. We won't be doing any eye poking. Not that they would really do eye poking, but people would come in and they would think they needed to be Perry Mason, or they would think that they needed to be some kind of tough debriefer or almost an interrogator. None of that was necessary unless you got sideways with him. If you got sideways with him, heaven help you, you know, because I haven't seen this much raw brain power in one place since the last time I sat in his cell with just him. He's probably the brightest person I have ever seen in my life, and I have seen some pretty bright people. And so he was very charming, immensely charming. But that is often how evil looks, right? If evil looks too evil, you can push back against it. If it's charming, then you bring people into the fold, right? You get them to act. He thinks he's a Jedi master, to use an analogy, and that these people out there who he's recruiting are Jedi warriors. Abu Zubaydah told me, I am a Mujahideen in a long line of Mujahideens. What you don't understand is that you have already lost. In Allah's timeline, the world is already under strict Sharia law, and I am just a warrior who is standing in my place. And when I fall, another one will come up. So So you have already lost. You just don't know it. Fascinating the way they think about that stuff.
Tell us about the time you were in his cell and he said, go get the lady who writes the notes. I have something important to tell you.
Okay, I'm going to be careful about this because I don't want to upset Daniel Pearl's parents. I won't give you the full story. We were pressing him hard. Actually, we were past the ITs, and we had a WMD expert in there. And they were trying to figure out if Al-Qaeda had any nuclear material. And the reason for that, and this is really the reason that in the beginning it was as rough as it was, we had credible intelligence that UBL had met with the Pakistanis that were distributing nuclear technology around the world to these rogue states that were outsourcing terror. He had met with those Pakistanis, and the Pakistanis said, the hardest part is to get the nuclear material. The hardest part is to get the fissionable material. And UBL said, what if we already have it? And so the WMD expert, not Jim and Bruce, Jim and Bruce are sitting in with her because he's not long out of EITs, but he's probably been out of EITs for about a month, month and a half. And we're sitting in there with her, and she's asking her questions, and she's done, and she leaves. And we do this thing I call a fireside chat, which is just sometimes when you take people out of one situation and you put them with a new situation, the dynamics of the situation will pull them to act in a certain way. So we go in and we say, the interrogation's over. We're still sitting there. The interrogation's over. Let's talk about how that went for you, right? And Bruce, who's incredibly empathetic and who KSM liked a little bit better because he had sons, KSM's had sons, and I don't. Bruce says, I noticed that you were uncomfortable at times, that sometimes when the lady would ask you questions, you would seem almost like you were going to say something, but then you would hold back and you wouldn't say it. And we had a couple of those sorts of things, like, what were you thinking about that? And he goes, go get the lady who takes the notes, which is what he insultingly called every female person who was three times as smart as we were, you know, who was actually asking the questions. But, you know, the jihadi Islamists who don't think very much of women. So he goes, go get the lady who takes the notes, and we bring her back. And he describes killing Daniel Pearl. He describes cutting his head off and dismembering him and burying him in a hole. I don't recall whether it was me or it was Bruce, but one of us asked him, was that difficult for you to do, thinking emotionally? This had to be hard to do. And he said, oh, no, I had sharp knives. The toughest part was getting through the neck bone, just like that. And then he started kind of mugging and sort of happy, and it was creepy. That was when, you know, you asked me what was he like sometimes.
So this is like, you know, he's Yoda, but then the evil shines
through. Yeah, the evil kind of shines through because he referred to Daniel Pearl as Daniel in just that tone of voice, Daniel, you know. And what you have to understand about KSM is KSM thought that what he was doing to Daniel Pearl showed his God, KSM's God, right, the God of Islamists, not the God of Islam, but the God of Islamists. It showed his God how much he loved his God, because for KSM, taking the life of someone who is helpless to prevent it, like you see ISIS doing when they burn people in cages or, you know, when they crucify children, taking someone's life who is helpless to prevent it shows his glory, shows how much his influence is. It's almost like an act of worship to him, not a hostile act. So he's talking about Daniel Pearl as if they had some intimate moment. It's just creepy. And after it's over, we're walking back to the cell, and one of the guards, because, you know, there are lots of guards there, says to me, that guy needs to die. And he didn't mean that we should kill him. He meant that the world would be a better place if that particular monster was gone. And
so let's talk a little bit about Islam. We often hear that terrorist attacks and Islamist terrorists have nothing to do with Islam. And you know, KSM told you a lot about his views of Islam. He said, for example, that Islam is a religion of peace.
Well, I'm going to answer that question, but I want to make one point first. KSM is an Islamist, and in my mind, an Islamist is a person who wants to impose Sharia law on the whole world. So if you're a Muslim and you're not an Islamist, I'm not talking about you, fine? I'm just not. When people talk about the Ku Klux Klan, I don't get insulted because I'm not a member of the Ku Klux Klan in spite of what some media people would probably have you believe. I just don't get insulted about that. So please don't take what I'm saying out of context. I'm not attacking all of Islam. What I'm saying is these Islamists who want to destroy our way of life have a set of beliefs that make them incredibly dangerous. So your question was?
So what did he tell you about this set of beliefs? Describe some of what he told you about what they believe. He said that Islam is a religion of peace.
Well, that was an interesting thing. One of the conversations I had with him in Snippet was I said, you guys are telling us that Islam is a religion of peace. What's that about? And he said, it is a religion of peace. The world will be at peace when Sharia law is imposed on the whole world. So we're a religion of peace because we're trying to impose Sharia law on the whole world. Right now it's not at peace because you have all of these different groups who believe that they can influence how things are going. He told me that Western democracy and true Sharia law could not coexist because we foolishly believe that we get a vote in how we live, that we can decide what our fashions are, that we can decide the laws that need to be enforced, that we can change those laws. Well, not true. In his mind, how we're supposed to live was established 1,400 years ago in the Quran and in the perfect words and deeds of the Prophet. There's no question about how we do that. I asked Abu Zubaydah one time. I said, Abu Zubaydah, how can you say that there's freedom of choice in your version of Islam? How can you say that? Freedom. And he goes, well, I am free. The perfect words of the Prophet Muhammad and deeds and the Quran tells me everything I need to do in my life, so I have to make no choices. I don't have any choices to make, so I'm free to do whatever is allowed. It's the exact opposite of the way that I think, right? It's the exact opposite of what I think. He told us that that Americans didn't have the moral courage to do what would be necessary in order to prevent them from prevailing. That we were, he told me that, and Bruce, he told us, and this was one of those conversations, not when he's being interrogated and not when we're trying to get intel out of him. He told us that our civil liberties, our willingness to be tolerant of other people, our openness, those were all flaws that Allah had put into our character to ensure that Islamists could win because they're just going to continue to do what they do while we make excuses for them. This obsessive political correctness, I have been asking him about this, but I'm certain if I sat down and said, what do you think of all this obsessive political correctness? He would say, hey, not a flaw, you know, and tell me that essentially what happens is it's a cloaking device so they can operate in the open without being confronted. And that is a big deal. He said to me that Al-Qaeda, now remember, when he did 9/11, he wasn't a member of Al-Qaeda. He had not sworn bayat yet to Al-Qaeda. So he's basically a free agent at that particular point. And he said that Al-Qaeda dreams of bringing down America with catastrophic attacks. But that's not particularly practical. He said the real way to bring down America was with low-tech, low-wolf attacks because the target is not our military capabilities. It's not our buildings. It's not our roads. It's the minds of the Americans. He said we don't have to defeat you. We only have to persist long enough for you to defeat yourself. We only have to persist long enough. And I talked to Abu Hadi one time, who was a military commander for them and did a lot of attacks against Americans. And I was asking him about how he stages ambushes, you know, why they didn't stay there longer and fight longer and try to kill more people. And he said, we only have to kill one or two Americans because it's not the Americans over there that we're trying to kill. We know we can't defeat them, but if we kill enough of them, the American people will want you to turn tail and run. And when you do, then we're going to be able to take over. That's the way they think. They think that they've been given a special position by their God and the right to dominion over the world. They think, and now I'm talking about the Islamists, not Islam in general, just the Islamists. They think that they've been appointed by their God to determine what your child's future is, you know. And if they don't do that, this is the piece that's so hard for people to understand. If they don't do that, then they will suffer the torments in the grave. You know, they're going to be judged. And whether or not they participate in the jihad, and whether or not they continue to do that in spite of all of the difficulties, will be part of what happens when at the end of their lives there's this accountability.
I think what we're going to do is cut it off there, and I think you will agree that Mr. Mitchell certainly knows the inside world and the minds of people that are Islamists, as he says, and he doesn't mean all Muslim people, nothing near that, but he certainly understands social engineering also. But talk about in-depth things that most of us don't know a zip about. He knows these intricate things about what is going on in this war and what the strategy is on the part of these people that are trying, this world group that's trying to overcome and defeat the United States and the rest of the world. And I think what we're going to do then is do this, the second half of it next week. We only got into 36 minutes of this, and it's an hour and 27-minute presentation. We won't be able to play all of that either, but a lot of that will be question and answers, probably at the American Enterprise Institute. But very interesting, and there's no doubt that Mr. Mitchell also understands social engineering. And, I mean, he has a consulting firm now, co-founder of Mitchell, Jessen, and Associates. And I don't know exactly what they do, but it must have something to do with these kinds of things. So, anyway, I thought that's a good little thing to listen to this week. And let me see if I can even get us out of this thing. I'm sorry about the tech problems this week. We finally made it down to one. So we're going to sign off tonight. And next week we'll do the second about half on James Mitchell, and he'll be talking about this enhanced interrogation business and all of its implications. And tonight we're going to ask Vera Lynn. She wasn't 100 years old when she first recorded this song, but isn't it remarkable that she's still performing? And we'll see you next week, and here's Vera Lynn signing off with We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again.